Okay. So anyone who's been coming to any talks in this program has heard lots about ADS2. Actually, I hadn't included it in my notes, but maybe I should actually start by writing down the metric of ADS2. If I want to point to it. So that's the S squared is minus R squared dt squared plus R squared over R. Okay, I'll point to that later, but that's just so ADS2 is. And why do we lock the ADS2? Well, ADS2 times some flat dimensions seems to be an IR attractor for a large class of holographic systems at finite density. If you take this space ADS2 together with some flat dimensions, and you add a Fermi liquid, you get a non-Fermi liquid, at least for some range of parameters. So this is a two-dimensional space. It has a one-dimensional boundary, parameterized only by time. So it has this funny critical behavior where only time scales, space doesn't. Or in terms of a dynamical exponent, that's z equals infinity. And such sectors, so in terms of frequency space, that means that there's critical fluctuations at zero frequency for all momenta, or for many momenta, which is an odd property, but it showed up a sector like this even in the original marginal Fermi liquid of Varma et al. They had spin fluctuations and charge fluctuations, which had, again, that kind of critical behavior, and it showed up in other kinds of models since. And ADS2, this space, because the horizon is basically a point from here times some flat space that has finite area, this space has a finite zero temperature entropy. So these are some odd properties. Certainly finite zero temperature entropy sounds very unstable, but even this scaling behavior is a very strange property. And it's led to the conjecture based on various examples that, in fact, although this seems to arise fairly generally as an infinite factor, maybe it's unstable. There are various ways in terms of the dual gravity theory it can become unstable, and the conjecture is that maybe it's always unstable because these properties are so strange that it always has to be unstable. Also, there's no good field theory model of this kind of scaling. It seems like if you look at field theories, the closest thing that comes to this is DMFT, where you're expanding around an infinite number of dimensions. And in that limit, you can get this scaling, but it doesn't survive at finite dimensionality. There's no good field theory model of this scaling. Most of the, if not all of the models that one talks about holographically are these phenomenological things where you postulate a gravity theory without having a specific dual field theory in mind. So what I'm going to show you is a system where you have a gravitational solution like this, where you know what the Hamiltonian is, and you can interpolate between weak and strong coupling. And I believe that, at least in some range of parameters, the ADS2 is completely stable down all the way into the infrared, and that this property survives both at large finite n and large finite lambda. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe by the end of the talk, the space will decay. But one of the reasons for giving this talk is to put this out there. The first line of every talk or paper should be, I guess I started on the dual side by telling you what the metric is first. And in this case, the Lagrangian, I'll write out, it's just the Lagrangian, the Lagrangian of the most fundamental, most characteristic example of ADS-C anti-duality, the four-dimensional, maximally supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. And I'll write it out sort of including, well, not at a Weinbergian level of detail, but I'll keep a few indices. Gauge field, Dirac fields, Klein-Gordon fields, Yukawa interaction, and a scalar potential. Okay, I'm going to use a few of these terms later on. I'll explain what the indices are, the I's and the alphas, shortly, because we'll need them.
Is there a conserved year one that you're coupled to become potential and you can write down, or is that?
Yes. That's what the I's and alphas. I'll tell you what it is in a second. But then the I's and the alphas are. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. So this is one example. This is in 3+1 dimensions. And a closely related example in 2+1 dimensions, so this is the second example, reduce to 2+1, meaning take the same Lagrangian, same fields, but just ignore their dependence on the three directions. So you get a two-dimensional field theory, and add n sub f fundamentals. So actually, I have to backtrack. So all of in this theory up here, all of the fields are matrices. They're all in the adjoint of the color group. Now we're adding some field. In the second example, we're adding some fields in the fundamental representation, the vector-like representation of the color group. Some number. This system was mentioned in particular by Eva in her talk. Not that long ago. So these are two nice characteristic examples. Well, the cool kids use something called ABJM, but if you're a bit older, this is the nicest, most characteristic example of ADS-C anti-duality in 2+1 dimensions.
So it also has a Suzy.
This one actually the reduction leaves four Suzy's, but the coupling to the fundamentals breaks you to n equals two. And these are both systems that, once you start with them, there are quite a number of ways to deform them and break them into systems of less symmetry, some of which I'll be mentioning as I go along. Yeah. Okay. So what I want to do first is, just in terms of, so this is N sub C D3 brains. This is N sub C D2 brains plus N sub F D6 brains. And also, actually, there's this nice M theory, M2 brain geometry that has arisen in various holographies. And this is a 10-dimensional theory, string theory, but you can also think of it as an orbifold of the M2 brain geometry. So this is simpler, but this is the field theory interpretation is more simple down in 10 dimensions. Okay, so what am I going to do? So first an aside, what am I going to do to this theory? So the first thing you might think of is what Matthew asked about, turn on a density. And I'm mostly going to focus on this example, the n equals, there's a lot of parallels between the two, and I'll mostly focus on this example, and every once in a while drop down to this one. But what density are you going to turn on? So what are the symmetries? There's an SUNC gauge symmetry, but that's a gauge symmetry. It's not an observable charge. And then there's also an SO6 global symmetry. So the scalars are vectors under the SO6. and the fermions are spinners under the SO6. And so we can choose a U1 in that SO6 and turn on a density. And it actually, the physics, and we're going to do something, again, this is still an aside. I'm going to use the SO6 in a different way later on. So what happens when you turn on a density? Well, what happens is you get a solution. So you turn on a U1 density. And indeed, you have this flow where the ADS5 geometry at long distance goes down to ADS2 cross R cubed. But this is known to be unstable at low temperatures where you'd be interested in the physics. The particular instability is this. You can think of the original geometry as being built by putting a lot of D3 rings on top of each other. And when you turn on this charge, they want to repel each other and separate. Like that. And when they separate, it means you're sort of developing mass gaps for lots of stuff, and you lose all your critical behavior. In the field theory, what's happening is these scalars here are getting vacuum expectation values and Higgsing most of the gauge group. So sort of physically, turning on the density produces a centrifugal force. I think you can say that. A centrifugal force that drives the brains apart. Now, this is annoying because it has nothing to do with the physics that you care about. These scalars, they come along for the ride in the duality, but they're not really the thing you care about. And so, you know, this is an annoyance. It's not something fundamental to the physics you're studying. There's other similar annoyances. There's the five sphere in the geometry, which there's the five sphere in the geometry, and there are modes where it can squash or it can shrink. And these are dual to things, again, built out of the scalars, usually traces of products of scalars. And in most cases, they're inessential, and they can run off. These modes can run off and basically gap the system out. So two comments. First of all, in these phenomenological, there's a philosophy that I have towards what these phenomenological models mean, which is since you don't care about these things, there is some more complicated Hamiltonian in which these have been, the assumption is there's some more complicated Hamiltonian in which these have been stabilized, we don't have to worry about them, and then we can focus on the physics that we want to understand. And that's sort of my interpretation of what these phenomenological holographic models mean, that we don't know what exactly Hamiltonian is, but it's in the universality class that we want and doesn't have these instabilities that don't matter. Don't know. Anyway, I don't want to do it. I want to actually do something simple. I want to take, again, a known Hamiltonian and get ADS2 out of it. I just want to mention because this actually is one of the things that was studied very shortly after Long's original paper by Clifford and others. And I'm not sure whether there's still something to be learned from this geometry, whether you can sort of ignore the instabilities and look at the transported at stable modes and actually try to figure out where this ADS2 geometry comes from. The main focus was on higher temperatures where the geometry is actually stable. But anyway, so this is not what I'm doing. This is what you would have liked to do, but I'm going to get the ADS2 in a rather different way. And it's a very clever idea due to Doker and Krauss. So it's to take the same SO6, choose some U1 subgroup, and turn on a magnetic field rather than a charge density. And again, maybe this isn't interesting for specific systems of interest, but it's going to get us to our goal of stable model of ADS2. So we're going to take, again, one of these U1 symmetries, and this is a global symmetry here, so we're going to add in a non-dynamical background gauge field, which again couples to this U1 charge and which is in a magnetic configuration in two of the planes. And This has, so it's the same Lagrange exception of an D slash, a covariant derivative, same Lagrange, except the D's now have this background magnetic field in them as well. This has a nice effect. So I wrote out part of the metric. I'm now going to write it down another part. So the magnetic field is in some plane, the 1-2 plane, say. And so if we look at just that part of the metric, in ADS space, it contracts as you go to the horizon. That's what's happening in the UV. But because of the magnetic field, that resists the contraction of this dimension. And so when you get down to the UV, it stops, leaving out constants, some dimensional constants. The main lesson is that the geometry changes you lose two of the scaling dimensions. They're stabilized by a magnetic field. And so what you have, you start with ADS3 in the IR, in the UV rather. Start with ADS5 in the UV, you get ADS3 cross two flat dimensions in the IR. You start with ADS4 in the UV, you get ADS2 cross. So I told you what's the Lagrangian that gives you ADS4, and now that told you what you're going to do to it to get ADS2.
Sorry, the charge is in another plane. Is that right?
I'm not actually going to turn on a charge in this talk. I'll mention it in the conclusions or something interesting to study. But for this case, the ADS2 is comes about without the charge density. Now, from the Bohr point of view, there's an electromagnetic duality. And so there may be another interpretation of this, but sort of from the top-down point of view, it's magnetic, not electric. Yeah.
Not that you're model building, but that might be kind of good for this marginal thermoelectric thing, right? Because then your leading transport could be caused by the fermions you add to this rather than being caused by the bulk.
Right, you're saying it might be good to add a charge.
Yeah.
I agree. Actually, I mean, I think this system is very interesting and deserves more attention than it's gotten. One of the interesting things, by the way, this system is interesting to point out by Doker and Fong, and I'm about to show you something about the field theory. No, Doker and Krauss, sorry. I'm about to show you something about the field theory that's also been Doker and Krauss. And they did consider turning on charge densities, and it's kind of interesting because in this case, when you start with ADS3, when they turn on charge density, depending on the parameters, they sometimes get an ADS2 geometry in the far IR, and they sometimes get an ADS3 geometry in the far IR. So there's some fairly rich dynamics when you turn on both the charge density and the magnetic field. But for this existence proof of stable ADS2, I'm only turning on the magnetic field. I'll come back to this maybe at the end because it is interesting. Now, that's what happens on the gravity side. You lose a couple dimensions. And what about the field theory side? So we've turned on a magnetic field. So these fields, the fermions and scalars that transform into that U1 are charged. And so they're in the plane of the magnetic field. Their spectrum becomes discrete, you get lambda levels. So basically what that means is that in the plane, you've lost those two dimensions, and you have motion only in the remaining two fewer dimensions. And so you see on both sides of the duality that the dynamics now lives in two less dimensions than before you turned on the field. Also, in this particular system, there are, for the fermions, the lowest modes have zero energy. So there is they have zero energy, so there's a very large vacuum degeneracy because you can fill that lowest Landau level in many, many different ways. And this was the observation, again, of Doker and Krauss. Okay, for ADS2, you have this is literally true. For ADS3, there's a momentum still in the surviving field theory direction. For ADS2, you get an understanding of how you get a degeneracy from all of the ways that you can fill this lowest lambda level. So it's a nice, this is nice. It's a understanding, at least in one case, of where this degeneracy comes from.
And the entropy matches?
No.
No.
No. We'll talk about why that is. No.
So this is
in
the free limit.
Thank you. In the free limit, this is what you get. And we'll talk about interactions, of course, are important. Right. Okay. So also, another comment, though, is we started with a holography where we had, again, the whole n equals 4 theory. If you look in the far IR, it appears that what you can do is on both sides, you can reduce to just the lowest entropy of freedom. And so there's an induced lower energy version of this where just the degrees of freedom of the lowest Landau level are dual to an ADS geometry of fewer dimensions. Although their Hamiltonian is a little bit more implicit because of the integrating out that you've got to do to you know, figure out what it is. Okay, so I guess what I want to talk about next is stability, because again, the statement, the claim that these things are I forgot, by the way. So again, that this system is interesting, and many of its properties were pointed out by Doker and Krauss. In a series of papers starting in, I guess, 09. And what I'm telling you about, it's been followed up by my student Ahmed Al-Mahari, and by Ahmed and me. And so the main sort of result I want to develop is in this claim that that this solution not only exists but is stable. And then I'll say a little bit about the entropy. Well, I guess the rest after I guess first stability, and then entropy. Now, so as we start to look at this model, we notice that a lot of the instabilities that I talked about that you normally have didn't seem to be there. For example, this centrifugal instability is kind of, in this case, offset by the Meissner effect. Once you turn on, in fact, it goes there. Once you turn on a magnetic field, the field does not want the symmetry to break, and so it provides actually a force in the other direction. And similarly, seemingly fortuitously, these instability modes didn't seem to be there, whereas they are there in many non-supersymmetric examples. And one way to understand why this system is so stable is, in fact, that there are supersymmetric examples. And the supersymmetric examples presumably have no direct interest for any, maybe they do have interest for some condensed matter question, but they certainly have interest in field theory. So I'm going to develop the supersymmetric theories first, and they, because they're supersymmetric, they have definite stability properties, and then I'll talk about perturbing away. So we have some supersymmetric system. We turn on an external magnetic field, and we'd like the resulting system to still be supersymmetric. And the way to ask this question is you look at sort of, is the system invariant? In particular, does the Gugino transform under under supersymmetry transformations? If this is zero, then the configuration is supersymmetric. Here's your background magnetic field. This is a sort of a formula that picks out one of the, this is from n equals one supersymmetry, picks out one of the four supersymmetries. And this is something that you get in N equals 1 supersymmetry. It's an auxiliary field. And if you turn on the Benedict field and you turn on also this field in the appropriate ratio, since this has eigenvalues plus and minus a half, then plus and minus I times plus and minus a half, there are zero eigenvalues, and so there are supersymmetries which are unbroken. Half of the N equals 1 supersymmetries, two unbroken SUSEs.
Do you have to Higgs the gauge group now that you're turning on a D term, or does?
No, remember this is this external field. It's just, and this is also an external.
Oh, sorry.
Field. Right. By the way, this same trick was used a few weeks earlier by Seiberg and I think Komargotsky for supergravity, which is a much harder application of the same idea. I assume that we saw their abstract and subliminally got the idea from them, but I don't know. We'll never know. Yes. Okay. I want to now go on to the N equals 4 theory, but this is now something that you can do in N equals 1 supersymmetry, the smallest So let me just consider the smallest example, which is one Fermi field and one bosonic field. And if you look at the Landau levels, so this is just diagonalizing the Dirac operator. I'm not going to write equations, but it's all in the paper with Ahmed. Then for the fermion, there is again the lowest levels at zero, and the next levels at some multiple magnetic field. That I'm looking at the bosons, and I'm going to have three plots here. Then you have, in the usual case, there are no zero bows. They kind of lie in between, which doesn't look very supersymmetric, and it's not. But what this D term does is, in terms of the field theory you're coupling to, it's a scalar mass. It gives scalars a mass squared proportional to their charge. And so depending on the sign that you turn it on with, my conventions aren't going to be consistent here, but so zero. You see that it's what you'd expect from the fact that there's a supersymmetry. At least with this sign, there's a one-to-one, a direct matching between the Landau levels of the fermions and the Landau levels of the bosons. With the other sign, there's a missing Landau level of the bosons, but that's fine because zero energy states are just invariant under supersymmetry by themselves. They don't need superpartners. And so with either these bosons or these bosons plus these fermions, it's a supersymmetric spectrum. And actually, again, in the case where you start with ADS5 and with ADS3, there's another direction. So all of these fields are moving either to the right or the left. And so another way to say this is kind of a heteronic realization of supersymmetry, where sort of these are the left movers and SUSE acts on them, and these are right movers. I'm sorry. When these are right movers, SUSE doesn't act on them, and they don't need partners. That's kind of the field theory reflection of that supersymmetry. And okay, now what I want to do is I want to just ask, how does this work in the N equals 4 theory? So let me look more closely at this SO6 symmetry that we've been talking about. So we can take our six R6 scalars make three complex combinations. And basically, we can take any SO6 generator, it'd be a sum of three U1s, which are just phase rotations of these three scalars. And so any generator basically can be regarded as assigning any three charges, to those fields. However, there's a super potential of the system, which I'll say more about later. But this, you can gauge any U1, but the system is supersymmetric only if they sum to zero. Or more generally, if their magnitudes, since there are several, if their magnitudes saturate the triangle inequality, meaning that the two smaller add to the larger. Okay, so the statement is that if you gauge a U1 in SO6 that satisfies this condition, or more generally this condition, and you turn on the correct D term, you will get some supersymmetric deformation of the N equals 4 theory, but with just two supersymmetries, but supersymmetric, and which has a low energy ADS3 geometry. And again, there's a corresponding story if you start with that 2 plus 1 dimensional example. There's an SO8, and you can again turn on a Menet field in a way that leads to unbroken supersymmetries. So the degeneracy in the lowest Landau level. Again, let me take the ADS3 case where you're talking about a 1 plus 1 dimensional effective field theory. The degeneracy is the largest charge, which I'll assume is 3 times the total, the usual Landau level degeneracy. And what you get is you get this many right-moving multiplets that have a fermion, right-moving fermion, and a boson, and an equal number of left-moving multiplets that have only a left-moving fermion. So the multiplets that have just a left-moving fermion are called fermionic multiplets. The ones that have a boson and a fermion are called, I think, chiral multiplets. And again, you get this many of each. So the central charge is, I think, 6 times that.
Okay, so your right and left moving bosons are different mass?
No, the bosons, everything at non-zero energy is just massive and doesn't have, it's only the zero energy states that could be chiral. The bosons are always complete bosons. They have both right and left pieces. But their super partners have only right moving pieces. And then there are left-moving fermions, which are not the superpartners of anything. And again, this is exactly the way supersymmetry is realized along the heterotic string, where you have right-moving fermions, which are supersymmetric and related to the space-time, and left-moving, which are just the current algebra.
So all these are for 1 plus 1,
D3? This is for 1 plus 1. For 0 plus 1, just forget the right and left moving, although there is just a difference in how the SUSY acts on two kinds of fermions.
But you still have two
kinds of fermions. Fermions which are distinguished by their supersymmetric transformation properties. That's right. That's right.
But you have the same number of left movers as you have right movers?
Yeah, you do. It'd be interesting if one could vary that, but that's what comes out. Yeah.
Is it enhanced to 2.2 supersymmetry in the infrared?
I don't think so. Interesting question. Interesting question. I don't know. I don't know why not, but I don't know. Probably not, but you would know better than me. You're one of the 0.2 experts. Okay, so that's sort of the field theory side. Now, because this, because again, there's this supersymmetric deformation of the field theory, at strong coupling, there should be some holographic dual, some deformation of ADS space, and there is. And I'll just briefly describe how one finds it. So sort of in the effective five or four dimensional theory, the ADS 5 or ADS 4, the relevant fields are the metric. The bulk gauge field, which is dual to this SO6 gauge symmetry. And also, some of these shape modes on the phi sphere have to come in, because when these charges aren't equal, they push on the phi sphere in different ways. And so there are these moduli, which was called something like that. And there's a nice Lagrangian called gauge supergravity that contains exactly these fields, D equals 5 or D equals 4 gauge supergravity. And there's this weird thing from supergravity theory where you solve this 5 or 4 dimensional theory, and then there's a magic way of uplifting this to a 10 dimensional solution. It's called consistent truncation. And it's not a symmetry thing. It's because the 10 dimensional solutions are not so symmetric as you think, but somehow there's some kind of magic that supergravity people know. And this, you can use this in this case. So you look at these solutions, you find in the supergravity the expected ADS 3 cross R squared or ADS 2 cross R squared solutions, and they uplift to ADS 3 cross something where actually the phi sphere is kind of squashed and also kind of fibered over the R squared. So it's kind of messy, but the solutions exist. Something like that. Anyway, so the supersymmetries exist exactly where you'd find them. An interesting, mildly convenient fact, I guess it's convenient, is we in the field theory, in order to get supersymmetry, we had to both choose appropriate charges and choose appropriate values for the D terms. And it turns out that the appropriate values for the D terms are attractors. So actually, once you get the charges right, the infrared geometry, in some wide range of parameter space at least, not everywhere, once you get the charges right, the infrared geometry actually just flows to having the correct values in the D terms.
Does that mean supersymmetry breaking is irrelevant?
It means in this case that I don't know if there are no Susie breaking parameters irrelevant, but these, which are dimension 2 at weak coupling, have a large dimension of strong coupling. That's right.
So is the S2 supersymmetric too?
I must answer yes. But actually, since the only ingredients, these are Kaluza Klein gauge shields. You know, I should mention, in many of the top-down constructions, you use gauge shields on brains. So these are all of the ingredients here are S2 invariant, the phi-form flux, symmetric, and so this, except for the dilaton going to the minus dilaton, this is self S2.
You don't get an electric field?
No, this is not a D3 brain. This is not a D3 brain gauge shield. This is a Kaluza Klein gauge shield, which is part of the metric, and the metric is S2 invariant. There might be some weird U duality that turns into a
shield.
So
do you have the same number of Mach right numbers? You can't ask that. I mean, for like Matthew's question.
So are there perturbations that mass them up? So the theory has remaining from the SO6 are chiral U1 symmetries. So you can't mass them up. That is, there are U1s that are carried by the leftovers and not the rightovers. So I think that means you can't mass them. If you break the symmetry, you mass them up.
Pardon? They're not gauged.
They're not gauged, but I'm just saying, as long as you don't, it's,
yeah.
Since you have the symmetry, you have to break the symmetry by hand to break it.
It would be symmetry breaking.
Right. Right. So I mean, one of the exercises, which I'll describe very briefly later on, is to look at the the dimensions of, basically, the growth of tachyons. And there certainly are fields which are tachyons but DF allowed, which means that they're relevant. So in some parts of parameter space, there are relevant perturbations. In other parts, there are not. But they all have they all are forbidden by symmetry. They're all forbidden by symmetry, so they wouldn't be generated spontaneously.
Joe?
Yes.
So if I just ask, how surprising is it that you found these supersymmetric examples of this? I mean, it occurs to me that way back, you know, one of the first supersymmetric solutions that was found was the extremal Reisner-Nordström metric. So in asymptotically flat space, right, the extreme charge black hole is supersymmetric.
That has occurred. Oh, good.
And of course, it has an ADS2 cross S2 near horizon geometry.
So the surprise is that in almost all supersymmetric examples, the ADS2 and S2 curvatures are equal. And you cancel two terms in the supersymmetric transformation by canceling the curvature here against the curvature here. And or the field against the curvature, I should say. We're canceling not the field against the curvature, but the field against this D term. Okay. Now, supersymmetry, so it's nice, so one reason that supersymmetry is so ubiquitous in this subject is that it guarantees some measure of stability because the Hamiltonian is the square of something, and so any state which has zero energy is really stable. And so we know from the field theory that this ground state is stable. And so all of the instabilities that you might have worried about, the various irrelevant ones involving the scalars, but also the more maybe characteristic ones involving condensations of fermions, are going to be absent.
So, Joe, what about your general argument?
Comes at the end, yeah. This system is an interesting system. When I talk about its interactions, I'll mention one of the reasons why it seems interesting. But it does have all of these bosonic zero energy states, which are kind of unnatural if you're trying to mock up a system with those fermions. But what's kind of nice is if you start to vary. So again, we needed this special condition on the charges to get supersymmetry. And if you start to vary the charges away from this condition, well, it turns out that the bosons move either up or down. If they move down, the system's unstable. But if you move in the other direction, they move up, and the system remains stable. But the bosons drop out of the zero energy spectrum, and it seems like in the far infrared, all you have then is fermions. So. And so let me draw, I think this is the best way to do this. I'm going to draw kind of the parameter space for these models. And again, the only relevant parameters are the ratios of charges, and more precisely, the ratios of magnitudes of charges. And the supersymmetric systems sort of lie on one of these three lines. And if you move outside of this shape, the bosons go in the wrong direction. If you move inside, they go in the right direction. And we've checked pretty much all of the scalars. We've checked the Coulomb branch. We've checked scalars coming from the metric, from the gauge field, from the scalars themselves. And they aren't always stable, but they're stable in some non-zero region inside this curve. And these are all non-supersymmetric theories. Actually, you can even do better. The instability that's killing you here is it has to do with non-abelian gauge fields. It was discussed recently by Erdmenger and some collaborators. And you can actually remove the bad modes by an orbital folding. So I think actually you can make the entire interior stable. Actually, we didn't explicitly check fermionic instabilities. Those Those are hard to find the right equations. We were lazy. And didn't realize, didn't hit us immediately how important that was, because of course there are Feynman instabilities in some of these systems. But we know that this can't be a generic issue, because we know that their their dimensions are related to the dimensions of their superpartners. The superpartners all have dimensions that vary parametrically around this boundary. The fermions are only dangerous if they're right on the edge of stability in the supersymmetric case, which could at most happen at isolated points along that boundary. And so there is at least some, and I think probably pretty large range, which is fully stable even against fermionic condensations. So that's the argument. Now, sort of that's the argument for infinite n. And so actually, we always talk about this being a large n phenomenon, but it's important to remember that holography has two large parameters, n and lambda. So n, the number of colors, and lambda, the gauge coupling, and the supergravity picture is always in the limit where this is very, very large. And we have to ask whether this property is stable against turning on large but finite values for these. And naively, the answer is must be yes, because again, we have a finite region of stability in here. The stability is not, in the interior, the stability is not marginal, it's absolute. And so a small perturbation won't drive one of these modes unstable. Actually, there is one thing that can happen and does happen in some cases when you turn on finite values for these parameters, which is the following. The theory may remain stable, but it may not remain conformal. And that can happen if, in the supersymmetric theory, there's an exactly marginal operator. If there's an exactly marginal operator in the supersymmetric theory, then when you deform away, odds are it's going to get a small non-zero beta function. And in fact, in the five-dimensional example, based the ADS5 example, based on the n equals 4 theory, the dilaton, the string coupling constant, is a modulus. These solutions exist for all values of g, and presumably, as when you turn on certainly finite n, where you would have gravity loop effects in the ball that would break supersymmetry, and possibly also when you turn on finite lambda, which might bring in higher dimension terms involving dilaton, this will start to flow very slowly. So for this theory, there's that one instability. It's a very slow instability. Actually, there's one point, the self-dual point. I've already explained that these solutions are self-dual. And so the potential for this dilaton has to be stationary at the self-dual point. And the curvature is so small that it must be stable. So in the Brighton motor field. So there's at least one example in this class of a theory that I think is absolutely stable. In the ADS4 case, where you eventually start from M theory, which has no dilaton, you don't even have that marginal operator, and so this can't happen. So I believe, and I'm quite prepared to be proven wrong, because that these examples are stable. They're stable within this non-supersymmetry breaking regime. I'm sorry, within this non-supersymmetric regime as well, and that the stability extends to finite values of n and lambda.
Joe, the n equals 4 theory has many more marginal operators. Once you break n equals 4, n equals 1 even.
Right, but they are all, I don't know of any that are singlets and could be spontaneously generated. Right, that's right.
Sorry,
but
this
takes
you back a little bit. How many flavors of fermions are in the lowest bound model?
How many do you want?
It's an even number. If you look at flavor symmetry, what happens in graphene?
Good. So let me move on. So that's the right time for this question, because I've now told you why we think these are stable, and the last thing, which I have just enough time for, is now the degeneracy of the Losanda level and how it's affected by interactions. Because, starting from a known Hamiltonian as we have, we're going to get some set of interactions at low center level, and it's probably not interactions that you've ever thought about or cared about. So these low center level states, you know, are going to do something that they want to do, not what you want them to do. So we're sort of getting to the parts of this that I understand less well, but I'll tell you what I understand about this. So in the models where you start with 3 plus 1 dimensions and go down to 1 plus 1, the relevant quantity is the central charge rather than degeneracy. And in the ones where you start from 2 plus 1 and go down to 0 plus 1, the relevant quantity is the ground state degeneracy. And you can, again, in both kinds of theorems, you can calculate both at weak and strong coupling. Again, at weak coupling and at strong coupling, at weak coupling, this is again just an enumeration of, at zero coupling, this is just an enumeration of lowest Mandel level states. At strong coupling, it's a Beckhausen-Hawking entropy, just the area of some horizon. And in no cases, except accidentally where two curves cross, do you get the same values at zero coupling. At zero coupling and strong coupling. This was first pointed out by Doker and Krauss in the ADS-5 case, and has been expanded by Ahmed and also me. Now, it's actually...
is zero coupling higher?
Good. So in the... So...
They cross.
Well, they cross. So good. So the... Just sort of as some background, in for the thermal entropy of the Angelus 4 theory, you know, the interactions make it smaller by this factor of 3/4. It's the free entropy, and it's the same as 3/4 that you run into the strong coupling. Here it goes in the opposite direction. That is, for the theory studied by Doker and Krauss, which is sort of the simplest value where all the charges are equal, the strong coupling entropy is larger than the weak coupling entropy. Now, there are interactions that's not a conservation. There could be attractive interactions that would do that. I think it's probably what's happening. As you say, area ratio, I'm not sure. There are certainly values where it goes the other way, but they may be unstable values. However, in the lower dimensional case, it actually does seem to go the other way. The strong coupling entropy scales parametrically in a smaller way than the weak coupling entropy in terms of those NC and NF. It's at weak coupling, you're discounting the adjoint field, at strong coupling, and this is something which is kind of characteristic in these D2 systems. It seems like interactions have somehow gapped out most of the degeneracy. Now, certainly in the zero plus one case, you're actually surprised at any degeneracy at all, because any kind of residual interactions will spoil the degeneracy. Actually, no, there is one, sorry. In the supersymmetric case, and only in that case, the weak coupling entropy is larger than the strong coupling. And also its interactions are, so I'm going to tell you the interactions. I told you about that Yukawa coupling. So up in part of my first Lagrangian was this Yukawa coupling, contracted with something that makes it SO6 invariant. And this, for the supersymmetric theories where you have both bosonic and fermionic fields, zero modes, this just descends to an effective interaction among the lowest, the effective interaction among the lowest Mandel level particles. It's something called the Landau-Ginzburg theory. And these things are nice enough that maybe it's possible to understand quantitatively the entropy. But evidently what's happening is that this is lifting some, in the supersymmetric case, this is lifting some, but not all, of the degeneracy. And that's typically what happens, you know, you have in these supersymmetric systems that you turn, so there, it should be possible, it's well known that the inverse theory that turning on superpotentials reduces the central charge in 1+1 dimensions by some calculable. In 0+1 dimensions, the question is accounting of supercentric bound states, which in some quantum mechanics problem, which again is usually is a non-trivial but interesting problem. In the non-supersymmetric, there's a commutator. Sorry, these are all matrices, and there's a commutator in here, and trace. In the non-supersymmetric case, you start to lift the bosons and you integrate them out, and so the residual interactions are something like this.
Yes. Are there corruptions to this potential?
For this?
Yeah.
I don't. Well, so it's a superpotential. There are certainly non-trivial Keller terms, but those are usually the effect of the irrelevant in the presence of Landau inferior interaction. But you're saying there might also be non-perturbative. I don't know. You know, this is you're another one of the 0-2 experts, say. Pass this on to you guys. I don't know. In fact, all of these things are deduced. These things are, you know, sort of the consequence of lowest order perturbation theory, and are not really protected by much at all. So we know one knows the ultimate UV Hamiltonian, but the induced Hamiltonian is more impressionistic. Yeah.
I just realized I'm totally confused about something. What happens to the
very good question. So they don't have SO6 charges, they don't have Landau levels, their kinematics is 3+1 dimensional rather than 1+1 or 0+1. So they have a much smaller density of states. They're there, they have interesting effects. Their exchange generates some marginal interactions, but they have a much smaller density of states. Geometrically though, they seem to actually be sort of they seem to have maybe just their interaction with the Landau level seems to have just lifted, even removed that much, because there's no sort of place to find a T cube entropy in this low energy geometry, or maybe it's in there at some higher order effect. I'm not sure, but in any case they're less relevant. If you break the supersymmetry just a little bit, the scalars are the lightest things, and so you think the things that they mediate are the most. But the vectors would mediate some kind of current thing. So now the claim is that in the 1+1 case, again the statement was that in the non-supersymmetric examples, the strong coupling entropy is larger than weak coupling and not zero. So the claim would be that. This is also impressionistic because there's an index for the Landau level degeneracy in here, and so there's some complicated index structure coming from the overlap of the Landau level wave functions. But the claim is that this particular for Fermi Hamiltonian, presumably this one, hopefully one doesn't, there aren't additional terms that are relevant, would flow at strong coupling to a control field theory, and moreover, a control field theory which has a larger central charge than the free theory, which I guess means from the C theorem, actually the flow is in the other direction. You have to reduce the central charge. Again, this is the part of the talk which I don't really understand. But this is, you know, this.
Sorry, does that mean you really flow out of the gravity regime?
It could be a fixed point, but it would have to be that it would be a UV attractive, not an IR attractive fixed point. In the cases where the entropy does what it seems to do.
Are there any cases where the Dalton remains exactly flat?
So we had an argument in our paper that was probably just poorly thought through, and I don't know that it does, and I think it was just wrong.
But if that's true, the central charges should just agree.
That's right.
Because, you know, you can't, along a marginal direction, you can't change
that. Right. Right, but the zero coupling central charge is, you know, well, yeah. Okay, so let me, I hope to use this to get some insight into the puzzles about the entropy. So let me just remind, not just the puzzle that there is a zero temperature entropy, but there's a sort of, there was this puzzle that the zero temperature entropy just doesn't make sense, period, and so there has to be some inferred instability. So let's remind you what the problem is, which I hope to get some insight into and haven't, and then saw. So in a relativistic system, let me give it in sort of the most primitive form first. In a relativistic system, the entropy scales as the temperature of the number of spatial dimensions, which in my notation is V minus 1. But in 0 plus 1 dimensions then, in a locally critical system, that's T to the 0 in a locally critical system. And Z equals infinity. But if the entropy is constant, that means that all states have zero energy. Now, of course, we've been talking about lots of states that have zero energy, and so this here they are. But this is kind of strange, because if all states have zero energy, there are no dynamics. All correlators are constant in time. And we know that's not true. We know that if you do the usual holographic calculations of correlators, you get instead correlators that go as 1 over t to the 2 delta, the usual, you know, scaling for a two-point function. And so, plus, I think maybe it's trivial, but I feel like it's annoying. How can this be true that you still have correlators that have non-trivial scaling with time? And you need this, for example, to get the marginal Fermi liquid behavior. Here's a related puzzle, which is a bit deeper, and it's actually a version that Hong Liu put forward, which is, I think, sharper than one that I had tried to, which is, let's consider a system in finite volume. Since the state dimensions don't scale, if you take a locally critical system, put it in finite volume, you don't break the symmetry, so presumably it's still locally critical. But in finite volume, finite n. That's one finite n. Pardon? I showed you systems that have ADS2 geometries at finite n.
Finite
n?
Not at finite volume.
Oh, not at finite volume. So you let me make a statement, and you can tell. So at finite volume, in finite volume, the spectrum is discrete. But the symmetry rescales, it's a continuous symmetry, that E scales E goes to lambda E, and so finite volume must always break the symmetry. How does one see this in the geometry? Because the geometry seems to have a horizon that goes all the way down to zero redshift. And so one long-standing conjecture was an instability, which I don't think is happening for reasons I described. Another possibility, which is something I've wondered about for a long time, is back reaction in calculations of things like correlators, because one knows that ADS2 has strange back reaction properties. Or it may be, this is the same kind of paradox that comes up in the black hole information problem. The sharpest version of the information problem is Wan's ADS black hole version, where this is the paradox. The discreteness is the paradox, and there the resolution really is quantum gravity effects. It's something which is very far, you know, it's some kind of strong quantum gravity effect that is not really understood, and maybe that's what's happening here as well. But I again throw this out as something that
Are there other saddle points that can mix with the ADS2?
I don't believe in the saddle points. They get just wrong. But
by quantum gravity, you mean e to the minus n squared?
E to the minus n squared, yeah. Right. We should, but course, I don't know, once you put it in finite volume, ADS can bifurcate, ADS can bifurcate and stuff, which is pretty weird. But we should talk about the saddle point sometime, and because, I mean, I probably, Juan believes them and I don't, so, you know, obviously I'm wrong, but, anyway, I'm done, thanks.
So, in Stroman, you're involved with the original calculation of the black hole entropy. You black hole, calculated the states at zero coupling or weak coupling, and argued that that was a good approximation, that things wouldn't change when you change the coupling because it was supersymmetric. And there was some debate whether they were calculating an index or really the entropy, but they argued. Now, here you have supersymmetric solutions, but you're not making that argument, and things
The
coupling?
Good. You know, there are indices one can try to form using, you know, U1s and so on.
But the statement is it's a supersymmetric solution, but right. Supersymmetry is just, there's not enough supersymmetry to.
I think they knew that they had no. We know that Van der Ginsburg models have a little smaller sample charge than models with no zero superpotential. So it's not strictly true that, I mean, so turning off relevant superpotential is a discontinuous thing. It doesn't preserve the entropy. So Stroman-Derivatha must have known that they didn't. I mean, basically.
So they lucked out, you're saying?
Well, I mean, to some extent they did luck out because these things were not clearly understood then. But having superpotential means that some of the things that you thought were sort of chiral are not chiral. Their descendants. And I'm pretty sure that if anybody would have picked up on that, it would have been those guys.
I mean, they actually built in the fact that they have a super potential in your language by working with a K3 target space or whatever from the single model. And that's what the Van der Ginsburg potential would give you in their case. The analog. You know, they have this K3 to the N mod SN sigma model.
What sense does that have a superpotential?
Well, if you tried to formulate it in some world sheet, in some.
You say if you try to formulate it, you actually start with more fields than a super.
It's a quartic super.
Right. Their system could have started in terms of more fields plus a super potential.
Yeah, but they built that in.
Right.
But that's not the problem.
So the gravity has two things. So there's entropy density, but there's also this. Scaling, right? Which is the entropy could exist without the scaling, right? So there could be a ground state in the gap.
Yeah, we want to know how they connect.
And weak coupling is there. Similar to these gauge fields that John mentioned. Why is there not a gap above the lowest lambda level? Is it a gauge field, or is it the large ends making all the lambda levels closely spaced?
Let me ask my same question again. Suppose you calculate a two-point function in this geometry. If this behavior persists out there in time, you know the continuous ones are gapless. And if you're seeing, you know, periodic, you know, wiggles. And so the question is, where does the calculation of the two-point function break down? And it might be that, you know, once you start to get very close to the horizon, you have strong coupling effects.
Isn't this just SL2R quantum mechanics, and this is a different time?
SL2R quantum mechanics is whatever you see. This supersymmetric quantum mechanics has this unbounded boson. That's nothing to do with any of this, as far as I know. It would give you this property, but there's no origin for anything, as far as I know.
I think that thing follows from SL2R symmetry, not supersymmetric.
Right, that's right. But it can't be true in finite volume, because it's a gap.
You have some bosons
that go. No, in the non-supersymmetric case, there's no boson. In the non-supersymmetric case, right? In the primitive case, that would be a possible explanation. In the non-supersymmetric case, I believe there's no boson. So there's no, by actual calculation, there's no boson. There's no branch.
Excuse me,
so
this is
a naive
question, but it is a chance question. So entropy finite just means I have some degeneracy, but I don't need the power state to be at zero energy. I just need the time of finite.
This was the argument. That is, there might be.
So do you mean the entropy is constant at all temperatures? Not just.
This is just dimensional analysis, right? That is, entropy has a volume in it, and so you can. So just dimensional analysis tells you that the entropy is a constant. You're grimacing here. Well, What is the antinomy? It's not this. You tell what is the antinomy? Give me a function that log t. Oh, that's okay. Log t. So it blows up as t. So then it blows up as t goes to zero.
But we don't understand.
Question.
It can depend on the volume.
Okay, it's pretty good. So this term might have a volume dependence, which is not extensive, say? So
it can be a function of these times
to the. Right. So that would be fine. So an intro, okay. A non-extensive, yeah.
If you think about the limit as equals to infinity, certainly the volume.
So how would you see this holographically now? It's not in the horizon area. Would you see it by doing loops in the ADS2 background? I think we're going to do loops in the ADS2 background.
But if it's not extensive, does that mean you have translation breaking in the...
Maybe these locally critical systems, although they're not even local, they're not really local, and they have warming effects that are not... that are necessarily there in order for the physics to make sense.
The reason I say it should depend on the volume is if you're at the finite end, then if you're in finite volume, I don't think you can possibly have any critical behavior. Analytic function.
Sure, absolutely. But the geometry is going to be telling you something different. The geometry
is a large end.
No, the geometry, what is the specific 1 over n correction that is? Is it a mysterious information problem, or is it something that is more?
I think it may simply be as,
we can solve the information problem.
That's good.